This afternoon, I'm with Anthony Caulfield again at Gabry Hardwick Solicitors and looking at an often neglected subject, but one that we think is incredibly important, lasting powers of attorney. So without any further ado, Anthony, what is a lasting power of attorney?
Yeah, good afternoon, Duncan. A lasting power of attorney is a legal document under which you can appoint one or more people who are known as your attorneys to make decisions for you in the event that you needed help during your lifetime. There are two distinct lasting powers of attorney, one relating to property and financial affairs, and the other document relating to health and welfare decisions.
Okay. How does this relate to the old enduring power of attorney? Because I know a lot of people perhaps completed one of their own for the old page enduring power of attorney. So if you had one of those, an unregistered old enduring power of attorney, which you thought you might use in the event of something happening, how does that now relate to lasting powers of attorney?
Yeah, the first important point to make is that if you signed an enduring power of attorney before the law changed, that document is still valid. There are various differences between enduring and lasting powers of attorney. With the old style enduring power of attorney, it didn't need to be registered with the court until you were losing or had lost your mental capacity and were no longer able to deal with matters yourself. With the new lasting powers of attorney, the documents have to be registered with the court first before they can be used. One of the reasons behind that was that the court were concerned at the amount of financial abuse that was going on under old-style enduring powers of attorney, because people were acting under the documents inappropriately without having registered them with the court, and therefore they weren't on the court's radar. The other point I'd make about enduring powers of attorney is that they purely relate to financial decisions, whereas with the lasting powers of attorney, as I mentioned, you can do a property and financial lasting power of attorney, which is similar to an enduring power, but you can also now do a health and welfare lasting power of attorney to cover health and welfare decisions which wouldn't be covered under an enduring power of attorney. Therefore, I would recommend anyone who'd done an old-style enduring power of attorney to think about whether it would be sensible to at least prepare a health and welfare lasting power of attorney as well. The other point that I would make is that as time goes on, financial institutions and banks become less and less familiar with enduring powers of attorney. They're used to dealing with lasting powers of attorney. So often I see banks can often raise queries or can cause delays because they're not overly familiar with the documents. You also sometimes have a problem that if the document's very old and the attorneys have moved address, that again that can lead to delays whilst the bank verify that the attorney is the same person mentioned in the document.
That's brilliant. I'm glad you touched on sort of security misuse and whatever, and we'll come back to that one. But I guess for a lot of people we speak to, typically they'll say, well, I've still got mental capacity, don't need a lasting power of attorney. Can you put everybody straight here, Anthony, and just give a broad church of who should be really setting up lasting powers of attorney and why they need a lasting power of attorney?
Well, I think, Duncan, anyone who has assets in their sole name and are anxious to make provision in case anything happens to them whilst they're alive should be considering preparing a lasting power of attorney, irrespective of their age. The reality is that an illness or an accident could happen to any one of us at any time. And if you were laid up in hospital incapacitated, and perhaps you had a wife and young family that needed to access your bank account to pay for medical costs or day-to-day family expenses, obviously, without the legal authority to do that under a lasting power of attorney, if you weren't in a position to deal with the matter yourself, they couldn't potentially access those assets. It's a misconception I come across quite often where clients will say, well, that person's my spouse, I can access their bank, their investments. Well, the reality is no. The bank or the financial institution will say, if you haven't got a lasting power of attorney, you're not entitled to access or deal with those accounts. So in a way, I would look at it as an insurance policy to know that you've put the arrangements in place in the unlikely event you were to become ill or have an accident. Well, actually, your loved ones will be able to deal with things for you.
I think you and I may have spoken previously about jointly owned property. So if one party had temporarily or lost mental capacity in a jointly owned property without a lasting power of attorney, just explain what the situation might be in that case.
Yes, it can cause problems. I mean, if you wanted to sell the property, etc., and the person obviously was incapacitated, wasn't able to deal with it. Well, the first thing to say is, you know, without a lasting power of attorney, the other co-owner on their own is not going to be able to sign for both parties. Even if you did have a lasting power of attorney, it is often sensible to think about having a second attorney other than the co-owner. Because if you own a property jointly as tenants in common where there's a restriction on the title, any purchaser of that property would need two separate people to sign the conveyancing documentation in order to give a valid receipt for the purchase money. So it's always sensible to think about having a second attorney on to cover that situation.
And we were talking previously about if, for example, you work for extended periods overseas, about perhaps the need to have a lasting power of attorney in that situation for assets in the UK?
Yes, again, if you've got a rental property that you're renting out your property while you're overseas, or bank accounts or investments, and actually it's not practical for you to manage those from overseas, but you want your parents or a sibling perhaps to be able to deal with things for you while you're working abroad. Again, having a lasting power of attorney in place would allow them to deal with those assets for you while you're away, so that things run smoothly. And then when you're back, obviously you can carry on dealing with things as before. So again, a misconception is, well, if I grant lasting power of attorney and they start dealing with things, I can't deal with it again myself at a later date if I want to. When actually the reality is, as long as you retain your mental capacity, you can resume dealing with your financial affairs yourself at any time in the future.
Okay, so we can say definitively lasting powers of attorney are not just for older people.
Yeah, that's certainly correct, and certainly I often prepare lasting powers of attorney for younger married couples of all ages, really.
Okay, yeah, that sounds very logical. So, looking at this more specifically, when does it come into force?
Well, as I mentioned, you have to register the document with the court before it comes into force. Once the document has been registered, then potentially the attorney can act under it. The registration process from when you signed it to having it registered usually takes between 2 to 3 months, depending on how busy the court are. Now, in the property and financial lasting power of attorney, you can specify either that you're happy for it to be used by the attorney straight away when it's registered, or that you would only want it to be used if you lost your mental capacity. Usually I would suggest that it is probably better to state that you want it to be used straight away once registered, just in case, for example, the situation we just talked about where you were working overseas for a period of time, or perhaps, although mentally you were still very sharp, you were physically incapacitated. Obviously, if you've ticked the box saying that they can only act if you lose mental capacity, then it might prevent them from acting in those circumstances. With the health and welfare lasting power of attorney, even when it's registered with the court, the only circumstances in which that document should be used by the attorneys is if you can't communicate your wishes yourself. The theory behind that, of course, is that all the time you can say what you want, you know best about your own health and welfare. But again, with health and welfare decisions, if you had a severe stroke, suffered from advanced dementia, or were in a coma, obviously in that situation you couldn't say what you want, and that would be when the attorneys would act under that document.
And who's the judge and determinant of whether you still have mental capacity?
Well, ultimately, if there is a dispute between you and your attorneys, for example, as to whether you still have mental capacity, it would be the court that would make the final decision. and they would have the power to call for appropriate additional medical evidence if required in order to establish whether or not you had capacity.
Okay. Ordinarily, what a GP reports?
Typically, I think if it was a case where there was a dispute, it would probably be a consultant psychiatrist specialising in older age psychiatry would probably undertake that report.
Okay. Is there anything else about the process that individuals need to know in terms of setting up a lasting power of attorney?
Yes, they should always think carefully about, firstly, who they want as the attorneys. The first thing to think about is these are powerful documents, and therefore you should only appoint an attorney to act for you in whom you have trust and confidence. You're not limited to just one attorney. If you appoint more than one attorney, they can either act jointly or jointly and severally. So jointly means everyone must agree and sign. Jointly and severally, they can act together and individually. There are some practical implications in having a joint appointment. The first thing to say is, look, if you've got several attorneys in different parts of the country and you're appointing them jointly, that's likely to be very unwieldy and slow in getting anything done because they're all going to have to sign. It also means if one of them's on holiday for a couple of weeks, well, nothing's going to get done until they're back. Also, with a joint appointment, if one of the attorneys were to die, then unfortunately the authority under that document comes to an end. And so you'd then need to look about doing another lasting power of attorney at that time. I therefore tend to suggest that a joint and several appointment of attorneys is more flexible. But obviously you need to be confident in your own mind that the people you select can work together, that you have complete trust and confidence in them, and that they'll always act in your best interests. The Mental Capacity Act, which governs powers of attorney, makes clear that an attorney should always act in your best interests, consider your wishes and act in accordance with those wishes as far as possible. Even if they don't necessarily agree with the way that you deal with matters, if that's what you want to achieve, they should endeavour to follow your wishes wherever possible. If you can make some decisions, but not all decisions, they should encourage you to make those decisions you can. And if you can't make a particular decision, they should act as least restrictively as possible to your rights and freedoms. Those sort of principles are set out in the Mental Capacity Act, which govern lasting powers of attorney. The other consideration with attorneys I always point out to clients is you perhaps ought to think about having someone from the younger generation. It's all very well and good appointing your spouse and possibly a sibling, but if they're not needed until you're much older and perhaps in poor health yourself, well, the attorneys at that time may have died before you or may be sort of unable to act for you anyway because of their own health problems. And that's why it's often sensible to think about possibly children on there as attorneys, or nephews or nieces, or a younger friend or family member possibly.
And from a practical point of view, what if the attorneys disagree on a particular course of action?
Well, again, you know, if there is a dispute and you're not able to make the decision yourself, ultimately that may very well be for the court to decide on what they consider to be in your best interests. What I would say is it does reinforce the importance of having attorneys who you're comfortable will work well together and will act in your best interest at all time, because the last thing you want is to be running off to the court to make a decision as to what's in your best interest, which could be time-consuming, costly, etc.
Okay. Something that came up in a particular case where an attorney had been appointed, so a client's current wife was attorney, she had died. Is my understanding correct that the previous power of attorney that had been set up would then come into force, so that might have been his first wife? What's the situation where if you've made a sort of subsequent power of attorney, so you had an original power of attorney and you've now sort of updated it, what's the situation there? Is it not like a will where, you know, if you make a new will, the other one's superseded and null and void, as it were?
Well, you can have more than one power of attorney in existence at any one time.
Okay.
If you prepare a lasting power of attorney, or you had an old enduring power of attorney and you decide you want to update it, you can formally revoke the old document. If you do that, then the old attorney won't be able to act for you. Usually you would prepare a deed of revocation, which you would send a copy to the original attorney and a copy to the court, and then obviously the court would update their records to show that old power of attorney has now been revoked. If you don't go through that process of formally revoking it, and then perhaps the attorney under your new lasting power of attorney dies or is no longer able to act, then yes, in those circumstances, potentially the old attorney could then carry on acting under the previous document.
Okay, so presumably whilst you have mental capacity, it is possible to change the attorneys that you've appointed.
Yeah, you can do a new lasting power of attorney at any time should you wish to change the attorneys. And certainly if there was a situation where you fell out with one of your attorneys, I would recommend that you formally revoke the previous power of attorney rather than, you know, leave that one still in existence.
Okay, so we've looked at the length of time it takes to set one of these lasting powers of attorney up, what part of the process or what the process is like. What's the cost to implement lasting powers of attorney, Anthony?
The court charge a registration fee of £82 for each lasting power of attorney that you register with the court. So if an individual did a property and financial and health and welfare lasting power of attorney, that would be a cost of £164 in terms of court fees. If you instructed a solicitor to prepare and deal with the registration of the documents on your behalf, typically I would expect the cost in preparing and registering lasting powers of attorney to be somewhere in the region of £600 to £800 plus VAT in terms of solicitor's fees, and then on top of that there'd obviously be the court registration fees as an idea of costs.
Why would you advocate people use, or generally should use, solicitors rather than doing it themselves?
Well, again, there's a strict process that must be followed. There's a strict order in which the lasting power of attorney should be signed in order to be legally valid. Certainly when lasting powers of attorney came in initially, there was a considerable number of applications rejected because they were signed in the wrong order, they weren't signed appropriately. So I suppose the comfort of having a professional draw it up is that, you know, hopefully you will avoid those problems and delays, which could be particularly important if you don't register straight away and then the defect only comes to light much later down the line, perhaps when you've lost capacity. The other thing is that, you know, these are important documents and there are important decisions that need to be made. So a professional will be able to guide you on the options in terms of how many attorneys to appoint, on what basis should they be appointed, to chat through the pros and cons of, you know, having particular individuals involved. There is also the ability within the forms to put specific instructions and guidance in, and it may be, you know, if you have, for example, particular wishes that you want to remain in your own home, if you require care, that again, a professional can ensure that appropriately worded guidance is included within the forms, so that everyone is aware of your wishes. You also need to have a certificate provider in the forms. That is someone independent who gives a certificate in the lasting power of attorney to confirm that they've been through the documents with you, they're happy you understand what you're signing, you're not being pressured into signing something against your will. Now, obviously, if you go through a solicitor, they would tend to act as a certificate provider for you if they're not the attorneys themselves. Whereas if you don't use a solicitor, you're going to have to find someone either with the appropriate knowledge and expertise, or someone that's known you in a personal capacity for at least 2 years that is prepared to undertake that role and give that certificate in the forms.
Okay. I want to come back to the point about misuse, because you too modestly there perhaps didn't talk about the benefits of using a professional firm to avoid some of those. But again, it's often widely reported about what happens if attorneys misuse lasting powers of attorney. So, and again, one of the things we were going to discuss was about making gifts, and we're often reading about, you know, gifts being made by attorneys and they were inappropriate, etc. So firstly, what's the protection for someone who's granted a lasting power of attorney?
Well, the protection, first of all, is that by granting a lasting power of attorney, you are appointing the people that you yourself have chosen and who you feel are trustworthy and will act in your best interests. If you don't prepare a lasting power of attorney, then obviously the only possibility in that situation is for someone to make an application to the court to be appointed your court-appointed deputy. But in that situation, you lose the ability to choose who undertakes that role, because anyone could potentially apply. And if there are tensions within the family or fallouts between the family, you know, that can often lead to perhaps the person you don't want to take the role making the application. In terms of protections under the lasting power of attorney, one of the big protections now is that obviously the document needs to be registered with the court before it can be used. Now, that means therefore that the court have powers if they have any concerns that the attorney is acting inappropriately or not in your best interests, to, for example, ask the attorney to provide accounts, to provide an explanation as to what they've done. And ultimately, the court have powers to remove an attorney if they feel that they've not acted appropriately in your interests.
Would you say that is genuinely another reason why you might want family and third party professional involved as acting as attorneys jointly?
Yes, or jointly and severally. I think if there are tensions within the family, certainly I have found in my experience, appointing one child without the other can often lead to a tremendous fallout within the family. Could potentially lead to the other child challenging the lasting power of attorney through the courts, which is the last thing you want, because it leads to delays and expense. So, you know, having a professional involved can often manage a tricky family situation between perhaps two children that don't get on that well. So it can ensure that there is someone independent there to oversee what's done and to ensure that it is in the person's best interests.
Okay. One of the things that does come up quite regularly is this business of, whilst mum or dad had capacity, they were making regular gifts. What's the position now? Lasting power of attorney has been registered in terms of making regular gifts, yes, thereafter, or any form of gifts.
Yeah, and this is a common misconception, I think, from people, that they think that they can carry on making significant gifts because mum or dad used to do that. And the reality is, when someone loses their mental capacity, the powers to make gifts as an attorney under a lasting or an enduring power of attorney are quite limited. It would usually extend to just normal birthday or Christmas gifts that perhaps the person who granted the power of attorney was in the habit of making. If you're looking at more substantial gifts, for example, for inheritance tax planning, in those situations, the attorney would be exceeding their authority under the document to make those gifts without the approval of the court. So in that situation, the correct process would be to make an application to the court for approval for the gifts to be made. In considering that application, the court would need to think carefully about the person's circumstances, what their likely future care costs may be, and be entirely satisfied that they could afford to make any gift without impacting on their quality of life in any way. And it's interesting, because when you then submit an inheritance tax account after someone dies, there is a specific question on the inheritance tax form that says, have you ever acted under an enduring or a lasting power of attorney for the deceased? So the HM Revenue and Customs are quite hot on sort of making investigations and inquiries. And if it comes to light that significant gifts were made by attorneys without appropriate authority from the court, then HM Revenue and Customs will be very quick to disallow those gifts in terms of inheritance tax after the person's death.
Really good point there. And I guess the follow-up question would be, if we were thinking about different forms of inheritance tax planning for someone who has lost capacity, lasting power of attorney has been registered, what are the limitations, or what can attorney then do regarding inheritance tax planning? So you've made the point well about the GISP, but are there other things they could do for inheritance tax planning, or at that point is it too late because the person's lost capacity and you would be overstepping the mark as an attorney?
Yeah, it's not too late, but it will involve going to the court,
right?
Because the person cannot make the decision themselves. So as long as the court are satisfied, so particularly if the person has a financial advisor and they can show perhaps with future modelling what their likely care costs are going to be, what their income is, and that there is more than sufficient there to meet those costs, then the court will certainly consider agreeing to substantial gifts being made to mitigate inheritance tax, as long as they are completely satisfied that, you know, it won't impact on the quality of the person making the gifts' future care.
Okay. So to summarise, what are the major risks you would identify if an individual doesn't have a lasting power of attorney?
The big risk is obviously someone doesn't prepare a lasting power of attorney. They then lose their mental capacity. At that point, obviously, no one's going to be able to access their cash savings or their investments. There may be bills that need paying. It's often a difficult situation for the family because they need to arrange care for the person concerned. The costs are mounting up. They may need to sell the person's property in order to fund the care. And obviously there is no legal authority in place for them to do any of that. So they're then left with a situation where they have to apply to the court under the debtorship process I previously mentioned. That is a very long-winded and expensive process. It typically takes over 6 months to get a debtorship order in place, and can certainly cost, you know, even for a straightforward application, well in excess of £2,000. So, you know, it adds to what is already a very stressful situation, in that you're then having to perhaps liaise with the care home to try to get them to agree to holding fire on collecting their care fees for 6 months while this debtorship order is in place. Planning ahead and having a lasting power of attorney in place will hopefully avoid those problems, because the document's prepared, it's already registered, you've appointed the people you trust and that you want to deal with things, and they can step in immediately and start to pay the bills, deal with your assets straight away that you need help.
Okay. Is there anything we haven't touched on yet, or I haven't asked that you consider is kind of relevant regarding lasting powers of attorney? I'm so grateful that you've covered this, because I make no apologies for raising this at virtually every meeting we have with clients, because I think you've made the case strongly for it. But is there anything else we've not covered?
I'd say, just from my experience, I mean, the lasting powers of attorney have really come more and more into the public awareness over the last few years, and are becoming increasingly popular, particularly health and welfare lasting powers of attorney. Any debtorship order to the court wouldn't cover health and welfare decisions. And certainly, I often find that clients are very particular about what sort of care arrangements they want. They want to remain in their own home. The family may know their wishes. And so certainly I would suggest that a health and welfare power of attorney is a very sensible precaution to put in place, as well as the financial side of things that we've touched on. There is one question that always comes up with health and welfare lasting powers of attorney, and that is the question of life-sustaining treatment. There is a specific question on the health and welfare form that says, in an end-of-life situation, so that's where there's no prospect of recovery right at the end, decisions may need to be made about resuscitation, pain relief, that sort of thing right at the end. Well, you are able in the health and welfare lasting power of attorney to give the authority to your attorneys to make those decisions for you in relation to life-sustaining treatment if you can't communicate your wishes yourself. So that can often be incredibly useful, where you know, it's always been known within the family, for example, look, if there's no quality of life and it's just prolonging life right at the end where there's no prospect of recovery, I wouldn't want to be kept alive any longer than I had to be. Well, if the family know that and you've granted them the power under the Health and Welfare Lasting Power of Attorney to make those decisions for you, they can obviously inform the doctors what you would have wanted, and that can often, you know, help at what is an incredibly difficult time in terms of, you know, that end of life care and decisions that need to be made.
Okay, brilliant. Anthony, thanks for that. It's going to be an unmissable sort of reference piece tool podcast, this one. So thanks for that, and I'm sure we're going to come back to other topics in the future. Thank you.
Thanks, Duncan.